for us to go ahead and get started. We are starting on Joshua chapter 6 today. And in some ways, Joshua 6, we could almost see it as the beginning of a new section in the book. I mean, in the outline that we're working from, we've split the book into two broad sections. The first half of the book deals with the conquest. The second half of the book deals with the apportionment of the inheritance. It's actually giving the land out to the tribes and clans. But within this section, we've not seen any conquest yet. Right? The first five chapters have all been ritual preparation for conquest. This is the first chapter where we are going to see the conquest proper, any kind of battle. So we should note something. We typically think of the book of Joshua as a book of warfare, and in some ways it is. But we need to consider the actual warfare only starts here in chapter 6, and it's only going to go through like chapter 12. Right? So in total, out of 24 chapters in the book, only 7 of them center on conquest, on warfare, in battle. And we'll see, by the way, just how this section treats battle and conquest. Right? We'll see how much battling is actually done in this chapter. But we should just note that the book's message is not primarily a militaristic one. And that'll become all the more clear whenever we actually see what the military style action looks like as it's recorded in the book. So this is not primarily a book about military conquest. It is primarily a book about God's faithfulness to Israel and Israel's faithfulness to God. And the conquest takes a back seat to that primary theme of covenant faithfulness. The conquest is there to demonstrate the covenant faithfulness. Jericho is recorded first, so as to set the tone for the rest of the conquest that we're going to read about. So from a thematic perspective, we should consider Jericho to be typical of the whole conquest that is to follow. And this was a typical way for ancients to understand warfare. We've got advice recorded down on clay tablets where a new king comes. I forget what nation it was for, but a new king comes in, relatively young guy, and we've got this collection of clay tablets where all of these royal advisors, these viziers, are giving their advice for the new king. And one of the viziers advises the new king, find yourself a battle real quick where you outnumber the enemy by like 4 or 5 times. And let that be your first battle. Right? Because the ancients considered the first battle of a commander to be really, really important. So if you were a new commander, you didn't have any kind of track record, your first battle had better be a victory. Or else, from an ancient perspective, it would bode really ill for you. Now, there's something, it's a little different with Joshua's case, but we have something similar going on, that this is Joshua's first battle as commander of Israel. Right? We've seen Joshua in battle before. But that was when Moses was in charge. This is the first time that we're seeing Joshua in battle as a leader. And so this first battle is going to be really important, and it sets the tone, it sets the stage for the rest. This also is going to set up an immediate contrast with Ai, which we'll read about in chapter 7. Right, so in chapter 6, we're going to read a lot about Joshua's obedience, and especially about all Israel's obedience. That's going to be the major theme of the Battle of Jericho. But then you turn to chapter 7, Verse 1 tells us the theme of that chapter right out of the gate. But the people of Israel broke faith. That's going to be the dominant theme of Ai in the following chapter. And so we get that contrast set up here in chapter 6. Before we jump into the conquest, we should return to the law for just a minute to get some important background for what we're going to read here in Joshua chapter 6. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 20. Verse 16. As we read through Joshua 6, we're going to reach a point where Joshua issues a command seemingly out of thin air. It's not given any kind of explanation in the text of Joshua, but it has its basis here in the law in Deuteronomy chapter 20, beginning in verse 16. But in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save nothing alive that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. All right, so this is one of the major backdrops to the chapter, that the seven nations living in the promised land are to be devoted to complete destruction. And here we run across a really, really important word, especially for the book of Joshua. And I'll just pick out, need to pick out an odd corner here to write this. Here, we'll just call this our odd corner. It is the Hebrew word haram or harem. It's these, every word in Hebrew is built around three consonants. And so it's vocalized differently in different places, whether it's a verb or a noun or an adjective. But the word always has these three consonants. Haram or harem. And it's the phlegmy H. The one where you're hawking up a loogie to say it. And what it means is in the ESV, it is translated here as devote to complete destruction. It is the word that is sometimes, in some translations, translated the ban. Right, when we read, I forget if the King James does this. When we read that this, that, or the other thing is to be placed under the ban, it is this word, haram, devoted to destruction. So we're told that the cities of the seven nations, along with everything in them, is to be devoted to complete destruction. And we get a sense for what that means. You shall save alive nothing that breathes. We're going to see that come up in the Jericho story. And it is going to, we'll see it come up a few more times in Joshua. This is a really important theme in the Law of Moses. Because it doesn't just come up here. We learn several things about that which is Harem throughout the Law of Moses. Go back to Leviticus chapter 27. In Leviticus 27, the law is talking about vows, the things that are dedicated to the Lord. All right, and there's all kinds of things that can be dedicated to the Lord in several different ways. If you go later in the chapter, verse 28, we read, "But no devoted thing that a man devotes to the Lord of anything that he has, whether man or beast, or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to the Lord. No one devoted who is to be devoted for destruction from mankind shall be ransomed. he shall surely be put to death. All right, so what we have read, or what we would have read earlier in the chapter, is basically the redemption price for all of these things that are vowed. All right, so if say an ox is to be dedicated to the Lord, but you decide, well, I actually kind of like that ox, I'd like to keep that ox. In most cases, you can go to the priest and determine a redemption price for that ox. And so instead of giving the ox, you give the redemption price. And that's what gets dedicated to the Lord. But in certain cases, in the cases of things specifically that are cherem, these things are not redeemable. No devoted thing that a man devotes to the Lord can be redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to the Lord. Right? No one devoted who is devoted for destruction from mankind shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. All right, so there is... what I want us to consider, especially from this part of the law, first off, there's no ransom for it. Second, something that is cherem is considered to be holy to the Lord. So whenever the Lord says, you know, dedicate or devote this, that, or the other thing to destruction, the commandment is not simply, hey, here's a thing that I don't like, you need to kill it or burn it. But that thing actually becomes dedicated to the Lord and becomes most holy to the Lord. We're going to see that reflected in the text of Joshua as well. Right? It's kind of an odd mix of ideas, at least to like a modern, especially American mind. The idea that these things are to be devoted to destruction because in some way they're bad. So like the people of these seven nations, they're to be completely devoted to destruction so that Israel doesn't learn to sin from them. Right? So you look at them and they're bad. But that dedication to destruction is also a dedication to the Lord. Right? Which... It gets difficult with the way that we think about holy. Like, we automatically think of something that is holy as being good. Right? What it means is it is dedicated. It is set apart. It's different. And so these people that are to be, these people that are cherem, they're not good, but they are set apart. Right? They are dedicated to the Lord. And the way that that dedication, that devotion, is played out is through killing them. All right, again, it's kind of an odd mix of thoughts from a modern perspective. But one of the issues that we will see come up in Joshua is that the things that are cherem are holy to the Lord, and that has implications for anybody who messes with those things. All right, the last thing that I want us to look at from the law before we jump into the text itself is a bit of narrative background. Jericho is not the first time that we see the ban, the law of dedication, applied to Israel's conquests. Because there was some conquest outside of the Promised Land as well. Go to Numbers chapter 21. This is, as Israel is wandering in the wilderness, they are on their way up to the plains of Moab. They have not yet gone around Edom. So they are still, let's see, what other maps have we got here? It's the one I'm looking for. No, that's the route of Paul's service. It doesn't matter. Israel has traveled from Ramses and Sukkot down into the wilderness, and they are getting ready to pass up along this way. And we read about this king who is a king in the Negev, which means the Southland. So from somewhere in the southern region of modern-day Israel, the southern promised land, this guy makes an attack on Israel. Numbers chapter 21, verse 1. When the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atarim, he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction." And there's our word, Kerem, again. And the Lord heeded the voice of Israel and gave over the Canaanites, and they devoted them and their cities to destruction. So the name of the place was called Hormah. And there you see our same word again, that the name Hormah is a play off of the Hebrew word Kerem. And it's got the same consonantal root there. You can even see it in English, H-R-M. So the name Hormah means place that was dedicated to destruction, or place, city that was placed under the ban, to translate it another way. All right, so this is something that Israel has done before, and it is something that is meant to be dedicated to the Lord. All right, so that kind of sets the backdrop for what we're going to see in Joshua chapter 6 this morning. Have any questions or comments about any of that backdrop before we jump into Joshua 6?
So, when they say, like you just read, I think you went over this at the end of Joshua. They said that they completely devoted them to destruction. And there was war against them for the time.
Yeah, so ultimately, like, one of the big problems of Israel is that they don't finish the victory that God has given them, right? So we're going to see from Joshua 6 just how easy it was for Israel to claim victory, right? Because God is already given them the victory. They just have to walk in and claim it, right? So we shouldn't get the picture in our heads that Israel has got to face this multi-decade-long campaign where they're going to have to just really painstakingly hunt every nook and cranny all over the land, and it's going to be this really bad, difficult thing. It's already done. They just have to step in and do it. And towards the end of Joshua, we're going to see the Lord tell Joshua, towards the end of his life, even though the job is not done, he has done his part. And so the Lord tells Joshua, "Look, from here out, for the rest of your life, you take it easy, you've done your part." But then after Joshua, Israel is supposed to recommence that activity of devoting the seven nations to destruction, and they don't do it. Yeah, and so it's not meant to be anything that's like super hard for them to do. It's meant to be a mark of their extreme disobedience at that point. So what we will see between Joshua and Judges is that things seemingly turn on a dime. As faithful as Israel is in the book of Joshua, they are the polar opposite in the book of Judges. We'll see it when we get there. So good question. All right, Joshua chapter 6. Go ahead and jump into our text. Now Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus shall you do for 6 days. Seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat. And the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord. And he said to the people, go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the ark of the Lord. All right. So what we're going to look at today is this first, basically this opening to the conquest. And we're going to see the same kind of narrative style with Jericho that we saw with the crossing of the Jordan. All right, we kind of asked, whenever we were looking over the crossing of the Jordan, how long does it take to say they crossed a river? Right, it only takes that long. But how long did the book of Joshua take to tell us that they crossed the river? It took like three chapters. Because the book has this deliberate, repetitive style where you'll get something repeated like three times over. And each time it's repeated, some additional little detail. Well, that was dramatic. So, wind blew the door open and then blew it shut. So, the text, again, has this kind of building effect to it, where you know exactly what's going to happen. Right? We already know here from the outset, the city of Jericho is going to be conquered. But the story builds up to that climax, slowly but surely, by adding small details one at a time, over the course of these retellings. And the climax itself is going to happen relatively briefly. Right? So the story spends basically one verse describing the battle itself. We've not reached that yet. But we're going to get a lot of buildup leading to this one verse. So the emphasis is not on the battle. The emphasis is on the ritual preparation for the battle and for Israel's faithfulness to God. So it begins, first off, with this report. Now, Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out, and none came in. So this is like the beginning of chapter 5. You get this really brief report on the status of the pagans. Right? You look at chapter 5, verse 1. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted. There was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. Right? Very similar note here in chapter 6, verse 1. The pagans are terrified. They are scared of Israel. The Jericho was shut up inside and outside because of the people of Israel. None went out, none came in. All right, this is basically what we have been reading the whole time. The victory is already given to Israel. Right? Canaan has already lost. And it only is up to Israel to follow through on what the Lord says. This verse about the gates being shut up is also tied to what we last read about Jericho in chapter 2. The last thing that we read about the city of Jericho in the Rahab story in Joshua chapter 2, was that the gates were shut. At that point, it was to keep the spies from escaping. Now they are shut again. And this little note might bring up Rahab to us, and I think it's meant to do that, to have the story of Rahab in the back of our minds, because Rahab is going to come to the forefront of the story again in this chapter. All right, and the closing of the gates signifies a couple of things. First off, the gates are closed against Israel. In other words, the city of Jericho at large is not going to take the same option that Rahab took. All right, so we've been talking about Harem a little bit. And you read in the Law of Moses that everything that breathes has to be put to death. You shall devote everything in the cities of these seven nations to destruction, like we read in Deuteronomy 20. And I think we've asked this question before, but was that an inevitable thing? In other words, did the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Amorites and all the rest of them, did they have to suffer complete destruction at the hands of Israel? Well, what does the story of Rahab teach us? No. They don't have to be destroyed if they will do the same thing that Rahab does. In fact, if we were to go back to Deuteronomy 20, you'll see that same kind of language repeated in the law, where whenever Israel, at least whenever they are warring against a foreign city outside of the promised land, they're supposed to offer terms of peace and only war against the city if that city will not accept the terms of peace. The Rahab story shows us that the Canaanites did not have to die if they would join themselves to Israel, if they would align themselves to Israel. Rahab lives because she did that. And we're going to see by the end of this chapter, she effectively becomes an Israelite. The rest of the people of Jericho had that option. But here from the very outset, we learn that they're not going to take that option because the gates are shut. They are standing against Israel. They will not accept peace with Israel. And so Rahab alone from Jericho is going to be spared. Rahab and her household. The shutting of the gate also harkens back to the flooding of the Jordan. So the city walls, like the River Jordan, are a physical barrier against Israel doing what God commanded them to do, right? They're supposed to enter into the Promised Land, and they're supposed to conquer the Promised Land. And the River Jordan stood as a physical barrier to them entering the Promised Land. God dealt with that barrier. And so all they had to do was walk across. Now they are to conquer the Promised Land, and the walls of Jericho are a physical barrier against that. And based on what we have read already about the River Jordan, we know what to expect here from Jericho. Right, the text has already explicitly prepared us to make this connection. You go back to chapter 3, verse 10, and Joshua said, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will, without fail, drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites." Right, the crossing at the Jordan is how Israel will know that the Lord is with them and that he's going to drive out the nations from them. Right, the crossing at the Jordan is like a down payment on the conquest. And so now that they're before the walls of Jericho, wondering, you know, how do we out here get in there to conquer that city? The crossing of the Jordan has already given them the answer to that. Just as the Lord overcame that physical barrier, so is he also going to overcome this physical barrier. Right, now, as we've seen several times up to this point in the book of Joshua, the narrative begins with God giving orders to Joshua, followed by Joshua relaying those orders to Israel. And as we have seen in the past, Joshua is going to fill in additional details as he relates God's orders to Israel, thus acting as a prophet, not only giving the Lord's commandments, but interpreting that commandment according to the law. The commandment sequence that we read here in verses 2 through 5, where the Lord is telling Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand." It's basically an outline for everything that's going to happen in the chapter. And the bulk of the remainder of chapter 6 is just following this pattern that's laid out in verses 2 through 5. "I've given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all the men of war going around the city once. Thus you shall do for 6 days. The 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. On the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, everyone straight before him." All right, so the outcome of the battle has already been shown to us before it happens. Here's the pattern. Here's exactly what's going to happen. In fact, notice that the Lord is already speaking in the past tense here. "I have given Jericho into your hand." And the battle is already won. It just remains for Joshua and the sons of Israel to actually step onto the battlefield that they have already won through God. And so what's described here for us, well, all right, so in verses 2 through 5, we get the battle plans. Does anything strike you about these battle plans? What kind of battle plans are these? They're not battle plans. These are plans for a sacred procession. Right, this is a ritual procession that is planned out here. You know, like we said at the beginning of the class, even here, where the story begins to focus on the military-style action, it's not really focused on military-style action. There's conquest going on, but again, the battle plans are not battle plans, at least not by any earthly standard. The true battle, as it were, is a spiritual one, which is why we have a ritual procession laid out. There's no formal military strategy as such going on in this chapter. What signifies this as a ritual? I mean, some of the things are pretty obvious. You've got the participation of the priests. You've got the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. You have the blowing of the trumpets. All of this signals a ritual dedicated to the God of Israel. Now let's see. Okay, let's finish up today by focusing on a prominent number that we have read in the plans. What number keeps appearing over and over again in the Lord's instruction? 7. You're going to march for 7 days. On the 7th day, you're going to march around 7 times. There are going to be 7 priests bearing 7 trumpets. The shout is only going to occur at the 7th lap on the 7th day. So we got this constant repetition of the number 7. Right, it's a number for completeness, but more importantly for this text, it's also a representative number for God. Right, it represents the Lord's presence. So this constant repetition of 7 keeps God's activity at the forefront, even when Israel is acting. Right, so Israel is going to be the one, you know, marching around the city. Israel is going to be bearing the ark, bearing the trumpets. Israel is going to be doing the shouting. Again, if you were to look at this through worldly eyes, it's Israel conducting a siege against Jericho. And yet God's instructions make it clear to us through the entire thing, that's not really what's going on. It's not Israel laying siege to Jericho. It is God being present among Israel, fulfilling his promises to Israel. And all of that is demonstrated by the repetition of these 7s. The period of 7 days is especially significant. I mean, first off, what do we immediately think of when we think about 7 days in the Bible? Creation. Right? Everything touches back to creation in one way or another. But more immediately, we should bear in mind another period of 7 days that Israel would have been observing at this time. Right? What important feast had Israel just taken? The Passover. Right, now, the Passover is, at least in the law, it coincides with another feast. You remember what feast Passover coincides with? Yeah, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which lasts for, guess how many days? 7 days. So Israel has just finished Passover. And they are to march around the city of Jericho for 7 days as they are keeping the 7-day Feast of Unleavened Bread. But again, this all signifies Israel's consecration to the Lord. They are being set apart for the Lord. And so the consecration of the last chapter, where they've all been circumcised, they keep the Passover, Joshua's visited by this angel, that consecration leads almost seamlessly into the conquest of Jericho, because there is still this ritual of consecration going on. as they are marching around the city for 7 days. And of course, like I think we've noted this a couple of other times, this also ties the conquest of Jericho back to one of the last major times that we saw Israel keep the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was their victory over Egypt, their escape from Egypt. So the book of Joshua just keeps tying the conquest back to the Exodus experience. And the Canaanites, we are to read through the lens of Pharaoh and through the lens of Egypt. John?
I'm just kind of looking something up, because it kind of ties into Revelation. When Jesus comes back, there's that kind of the seven angels will blow seven trumpets.
Yeah.
And I never thought about that. When he comes back, there will be seven different angels. And a lot
of yes. Yeah, the numerology there is very significant. That's what... Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yehoshua was. That would have been Jesus' name in Hebrew or Aramaic. It's the same as Joshua.
So you just see so many instances where the Old Testament ties into the New Testament.
Yep.
And it's like that God's going to come back and fulfill all his promises.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why I'm glad you bring up Revelation, because long term, eventually, I do want to come around to a study of the book of Revelation. But the prerequisite for that is studying the rest of the Bible. Because you see, everything gets tied together in the book of Revelation. We absolutely hear echoes of Jericho in the book of Revelation. So, good point, John. All right. Well, we are basically out of time. So, next week, we will jump into the actual days of the conquest and see how that unfolds. I think the last thing, I'll just leave you with a little almost inconsequential thing. Leave on a light note. We're going to read a lot about the blowing of the trumpets. And there's a word that is, it's common enough even in the modern day that y'all might as well learn it, might as well know it. It's a pretty easy word. And if you know anybody who's Jewish, it's almost guaranteed that they've got one of these at home. The word is shofar. Right, that is the Hebrew word for the ram's horn trumpet. So over the course of this class, we're going to be talking about blowing the shofar. The plural of that is shofarot. So we'll be mentioning that over the next week or however long it takes us to finish up this class on the conquest of Jericho. So, but the shofar is still blown to this day. Again, if you know somebody who's a practicing Jew, it's guaranteed that they know what a shofar is, and they probably even have one at home. So if you go visit them and you see a ram's horn sitting out, there's their shofar. Then you ask them how long they can blow it for, and I guarantee you they'd be more than happy to show up how long they can sound the horn. That's a competition among them. All right, thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments this morning. So let's head on out and get some fresh air before...